This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Iranian government's crackdown on protesters seems to have stopped the large street demonstrations. Authorities have warned they won't tolerate further protests. But Mir Hussein Mousavi has asked Iranians to continue their protests in a creative way. Mousavi was President Ahmadinejad's chief opponent, has led the opposition, and has called the election illegitimate. It's hard to tell what's next, especially with the restrictions the government has placed on journalists. Many reporters have been arrested, including one from Newsweek. My guest, Christopher Dickey, is Newsweek's Middle East regional editor and Paris bureau chief. He's in Paris now and has been keeping in touch with his contacts in Iran, as well as watching the European response to the crackdown. Christopher Dickey's latest book is called Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counter-Terror Force, the NYPD. Christopher Dickey, welcome back to Fresh Air. Since you work for Newsweek and you've been with Newsweek for so long, I want to start by asking you about the Newsweek reporter who is still under arrest in Iran, Mazyar Bahari. And he's covered Iran for Newsweek for over a decade. He was arrested during the protests, and he has confessed, whatever this means, you know, he confessed, I'll assume it's probably under pressure, that his election coverage was biased in favor of the opposition, and that he admitted that as a journalist, he's part of the capitalist machinery that gets caught up in revolutionary activities aimed at throwing the legitimacy of the election in doubt. What do you know about this statement and about the condition that he's in?
Almost nothing. We don't even know if he made that statement. It looked like it was being videotaped in the press release that was put up on the web, but we haven't seen that video. Nobody has seen Mazyar. He's been able to talk to his mother twice on the telephone in the last 10 days, but no lawyer has seen him. No member of his family has seen him. Certainly nobody from Newsweek or no one from the Canadian Diplomatic Corps has been able to see him. So we don't know what condition he's in. We don't know how much duress he's under. And we certainly don't know the circumstances under which he delivered this rather bizarre testimonial to the cause of the government. Mazyar is a Canadian citizen, a Canadian passport holder, and the Canadian government has taken the lead in making démarche with the Iranian government to try and assure that Mazyar is being well treated, to find out exactly where he is, what, if any, charges there are against him. I'm afraid they haven't gotten very far so far. At the same time, Newsweek, of course, is doing everything it can in terms of publicity, in terms of making the case that Mazyar is what he is, a very fair, honest, and unbiased reporter whose work has been really beyond reproach for the last 10 years when he's been with us, and whose documentaries really are excellent views of the complexities and texture of Iranian life. They're not political diatribes. He's not that kind of person. So we think that eventually the government in Iran is going to understand it just doesn't have the kind of person that should be in jail. It has the kind of person who should be telling the truth about what's going on in Iran from all sides, which is exactly what Mazyar has always done.
Well, I hope he is well and gets released soon. Let's look at where things seem to stand now in Iran. Mir Hussein Mousavi, who was the chief opponent to Ahmadinejad, has called the election results illegitimate. That's a recent statement of his. And the former president, Khatami, issued a recent statement too. What did he have to say?
He was very tough. He talked about what's happened over the last couple of weeks as a velvet coup. You know, the government likes to talk about efforts to mount a velvet revolution, what they call a color revolution, like the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. Khatami has come right back at them. This is a man who was president of Iran for 8 years and has said, no, this is a velvet coup. And he used very tough language. He said, those who were required to protect people's rights humiliated the people. Yet it, the government, speaks of national reconciliation and peace. This is very, very tough language. But I have to say, it all sounds a little bit like a last stand, a last taking of positions before the lights go out, because it doesn't look as if they can muster the presence on the streets or the economic or political clout to overturn these results.
So you think it's just a way of saying, we're right and you're wrong, we still believe it, we're not giving in, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's much life left in the movement.
I'd say that's a pretty fair description of the situation. I don't think that they can stand up against the force of the Revolutionary Guards and of the concerted power of the Basij, the intelligence ministry, the supreme leader, and President Ahmadinejad. You've seen that the streets have calmed, that order has been restored, the protests have died down, and there are efforts now to find other forms of protest, a general strike, these kinds of things. But I think it's unlikely that they can continue or rebuild, in fact, the momentum that they had a week or a little more than a week ago.
Now, I read that Mousavi called for a strike. What do you know about that?
Not much, only that he called for one. I think we'll have to see if the country shuts down. I personally don't expect to see that happen. But if it does, then we will enter yet another phase in a saga that has indeed been full of surprises. I think none of us could have predicted 2 weeks ago even that we would have seen so much upheaval, so many twists and turns in this situation, so much public infighting among the clergy. You know, the assumption was always that you had different candidates and different players and they had different rivalries, but basically they were all within the system. Now you have people who were formerly very much part of the system, albeit on a reformist or liberal wing of it, who are challenging the system itself, who are saying, you know, your Islamic revolution, that is Khamenei's and Ahmadinejad's, is not our Islamic revolution. And this is a fight about what direction it's going to take. That's really, really very amazing. But the reformists seem to me to be in a fundamentally weak position. They don't have strong enough leadership, and they certainly don't have the power of force of arms that exists with the government.
So you think that the reformists are looking for an alteration of the Islamic State, not for an alternative to an Islamic State?
Well, that's what they're saying. But the way revolutions work, they usually start out with attempts at evolutionary change that is frustrated, and then that becomes more and more revolutionary, and suddenly the demands, go back to the French Revolution, originally there was no effort to overthrow the monarchy, but somehow as the process of revolution progressed, the monarch became superfluous and then an obstacle to the change that was wanted by the revolutionaries. That's a classic pattern of revolution, and that could be the pattern in Iran if the movement that we saw 10 days ago carried forward. But I think it has been stopped. Everybody I've talked to in Tehran over the last few days on the telephone has said basically this is Custer's last stand. This is a final gesture, but this is not. This movement will, to some extent, go underground. It will simmer. People probably certainly won't forget it, but it won't be able to regain any kind of momentum anytime in the near future.
Is there leadership of the protests? I know, you know, Mousavi has called for a strike. Mousavi contested the election. But are there people actually strategizing how to get people together and what the action should be?
Well, there could be, but we don't know what shape that leadership has. One of the things that worries the government is that the reformers, the reformist movement, is made up of people who were really the activists and organizers and revolutionaries who made the 1978-79 revolution happen. Now, they are 30 years older. They're no longer 20-year-old kids out in the street. They're middle-aged men and, in a few cases, women. But they do know what the dynamics are. They do know how this works. They know about clandestine organization, and they know how to get people out on the streets under certain circumstances. But they also are facing a much more resolute antagonist in the form of Ahmadinejad and Khamenei than they were facing in the Shah in his final days. So all of that's at play. The regime thinks these people can be dangerous, but for the moment we haven't seen that they have the ability to organize a sustained movement in today's world, in today's Iran.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Dickey. He's Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Dickey. He's the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek. Christopher Dickey, you're speaking to us from Paris, where you're based. The European Union is considering withdrawing the ambassadors of all 27 of its member nations in protest of the arrest of British embassy workers. 9 were arrested, 8 have been released, 1 remains in detention. What would that mean if the European Union withdrew all of its ambassadors from Iran?
Well, it would be a strong gesture, but it would also tend to create a situation where we know even less about what's going on in Iran than we do now. And the question would be, how long would they keep those ambassadors out of Iran? Part of what the Iranian government is doing right now is asserting its independence from the rest of the world. This is a line that Ahmadinejad, the president, has pushed very strongly, that Ayatollah Khamenei has pushed very strongly, that the world will come to us Iranians eventually, almost no matter what. And so I think they're perfectly willing and able to weather the withdrawal of even all of the European Union ambassadors. And probably the European Union will be making its own situation more difficult. But I can understand why European officials would feel that they need to make some sort of gesture given the arrest of the local staff of the British embassy.
Why would it make the situation for the European Union more difficult if it withdrew its ambassadors to Iran?
Well, you know, it's always a problem when you withdraw diplomatic representation, when you withdraw the people who are on the ground trying to figure out what's going on in a country. And Iran is one of the most complicated and difficult to understand countries in the world. I was talking to former ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker, the other day. He started his career serving in Iran, and he says, look, we haven't been there for 30 years, and it's hard to know what's going on when you're on the ground. So second-guessing what's happening from afar is that much more difficult. And if you take your ambassador out and if you start to pare back your embassy staff, eventually you're blinding yourself to whatever events are going on. Now, if you have a situation where your embassy staff try to work and they're just getting arrested and seem to enjoy no immunity whatsoever, well, maybe this is the only thing you can do, but it's never, in principle, a good idea to blind yourself to events in a country that's as important as Iran.
Don't some of the members of the EU have trade relations with Iran?
Lots of them have trade relations with Iran. Most of them, I think, have trade relations with Iran, and some have quite good relations with Iran. Traditionally, Germany is one of Iran's biggest trading partners. Italy has a lot of commerce with Iran. So it's definitely not a question of these are thin little diplomatic representations that are now being withdrawn. There's a lot of representation in Tehran, and there has been for a long time a lot of commercial and diplomatic intercourse between Tehran and many European capitals.
So for the countries that have trade relations with Iran, if they withdrew their ambassadors, would they continue to trade anyways?
Well, it's on the question of trade relations that the real, that the rubber meets the road, as it were. If we start to see Iran's major trading partners starting to put economic pressure on Iran, then I think that starts to be some kind of effective diplomatic and economic move. That begins to have some teeth in it. But we haven't really seen that yet. And Iran knows that it also has alternatives. As long as it can turn to China, as long as it can turn to Russia, it will be able to undermine the European position, even of its major trading partners. And as long as oil prices continue to go back up, the Iranian government is going to feel protected. I think, you know, traditionally in Iran, over the last several years, when oil prices have been very low, you saw a rise of the reform movement. And when oil prices have gone up, you saw the hardliners in ascendancy because they could basically give lots of money to the people, just distribute the oil wealth. And as we see the oil wealth increasing again, we're going to see the hardliners in a stronger position because, they will think the world will come to them, and they are probably right.
There was a time when the United States was the great Satan in Iran, but it seems like maybe we've been replaced by the British. The British are now officially, quote, the most treacherous of enemies. And I think that was that
But the Iranians have believed that for a very long time. That's not
really
new.
What?
Absolutely. It goes back to the 19th century and the great game between Britain and Russia and Iran and all the duplicity and treachery that took place and the British efforts to take over Iranian oil in the early part of the 20th century and support for dictators and shahs and coups and all kinds of things. You know, the Americans are usually blamed for the coup in 1953 that overthrew the Mossadegh government and put the Shah back on the throne. But, in fact, the British played a vital role in that as well. There is an Iranian proverb that's repeated a lot these days that if you trip over a stone, the British put it there. That is the way people feel. You know, there's historical grievances run very deep in that part of the world. And actually, one of the ironies of Iran is that if you go there as an American, you discover very quickly that Iranians tend to like Americans. They may stand around in small groups in front of television cameras and shout death to America. But when you're just on the street and just talking to people, you get a very friendly reception. The people the Iranians traditionally mistrust are the British, and it has to be said also the Russians, also dating back to the days of the Great Game.
You know, President Obama has spoken of trying to begin some kind of discussion with Iran, you know, about the nuclear program. And I'm wondering if you think there's any chance that that will go forward if the government wins over the protesters, and it looks like things are heading in that direction.
Well, I think we can say that the government has won over the protesters. I think that that movement is essentially at an end, at least as we saw it in the first days after the election results were announced. And I think the Obama administration has really got a huge problem in dealing with this this government. It is a government that has asserted its power, that is asserting its not only its independence, but that wants to confront the West. This government is looking for legitimacy now. Its legitimacy was challenged by the masses of people in the streets. Its legitimacy has been challenged by all those people who say that the elections were rigged. Its legitimacy is challenged by its resorting to force to deal with this situation. So how is it going to regain its legitimacy? Well, one way to do that is to just keep insisting. The elections were not rigged. The people love us. Everything is fine. But the other way to get legitimacy is to show that the rest of the world comes to your door and wants to negotiate with you. And the decision, the first decision that the Obama administration is going to have to make is whether it thinks those negotiations are so important that it is going to be a party to the legitimizing of this government. And I don't think they've sorted that one out in Washington.
So if you talk, you legitimize the government, and if you don't talk, you have other problems.
That's right. If you don't talk, then the Iranians continue to pursue their nuclear program. You have no hope of stopping them unless you endorse military action. And for many, many reasons, that would be neither practical nor wise. So ultimately, you have to talk to them. And they know that. That's the box that the Obama administration finds itself in right now. And I think ultimately it will talk to this government.
Now, you've written that dictators around the world are watching Iran for lessons learned. Why is what happens in Iran important to Arab regimes?
Well, I think what's important is the whole question of passive resistance and whether that can succeed and be revived and keep pushing. Whether in the 21st century you can see the kinds of movements that, for instance, Gandhi represented in India or that Martin Luther King Jr. represented in the United States, of powerful, nonviolent protest that changes the face of government and changes the laws of the land, changes the givens in which everybody operates. And there's very little record of that in the Middle East. So one of the things that was striking about this is that suddenly, almost out of the blue it seemed, you had these popular protests going on massively in the streets of Tehran in the days immediately after the elections, or the election results were announced. And that seemed like a new paradigm. If you had seen that continue and seen the government essentially cede more and more space to the protesters until eventually the protesters had the upper hand, That would have worried a lot of people, I think, in the Arab world, particularly in a place like Egypt, for instance, where you have an autocracy that's been in power for a long time. President Mubarak is now a very old man who's been in power since 1981. You have the military establishment there that's been in power since the early 1950s. Could it stand up to mass movements, to this educated young people from universities holding down jobs who go out in the streets and say, we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore? And the answer is it would be really tough. It would be really tough without essentially resorting to draconian and violent means of containing those movements, which is what happened in Iran.
Christopher Dickey will be back in the second half of the show. He's Newsweek's Middle East regional editor and Paris bureau chief. His latest book is called Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Middle East regional editor and Paris bureau chief. In Newsweek Online, Dickey writes the Shadowland column about the Middle East, counterterrorism, and espionage. We're talking about Iran. He's joining us from Paris. You know, certainly in the United States, in the past couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of videos sent by, you know, Twitter and other social network sites and of demonstrations in the streets of Iran. And of course, the question is always, can you trust everything that you see? Are they all of scenes that they purport to be showing? What is the agenda of the people sending the images and so on? And I'm wondering if you've been having to, you know, as a journalist, make decisions about which images you're going to trust and which you're not.
Absolutely. And I think none of them are that trustworthy. If you see a long shot of an enormous crowd walking through the middle of Tehran, okay. That I think we can rely on. And those were the kinds of shots, I think, that first interested people in the immediacy of that kind of coverage. But once you get down to little video, little blurry video clips of shooting incidents or confrontations between the besieged and the protesters or the protesters and the police, it's very hard to judge the context. In fact, it's impossible to judge the context in which those were shot. And I think that none of them should be taken at face value.
What about the most famous of all the images that have come out of Iran? And that is of Neda, the young woman who was shot and died and has become kind of the symbol of the opposition movement. How do you interpret what you've seen?
Well, the fact that she's shot and the fact that she dies is unassailable, and that it happened in the midst of a protest is also unquestionable. Who shot her? I don't know. People who were there or say they were there say that she was shot by a member of the besiege. Why a member of the besieged would just decide to shoot her is unclear. That these guys are rough, that they're thugs, that they beat people up, that sometimes they shoot people and kill them, yes. Why did they kill her? Hard to know. Was she shot by another protester? Seems implausible. But you can't know. You can't know. And ultimately, these become tests of faith for people who comment on this, and you see it all the time. It is, for the opposition now, it would be heresy to raise any question that Neda was killed by the besiege. And for the government, it is heresy to say that the besiege could possibly have killed her. So ultimately, we just don't know, except that a young woman was cut down in the prime of her life, and the whole world had an opportunity to watch that horrifying moment when somebody actually dies in front of your eyes.
You've written something that really surprised me. You wrote that privately, American officials say there are indications of fraud in the election, but they believe Ahmadinejad would have won anyways. And then you write, it's ironic that the greatest internal threat to the regime in its entire 30 years may have been provoked by rulers who felt they had to steal an election they'd already won. Anyways, I was really surprised to read that Obama administration officials told you that they think that,
well,
in spite of the fraud, Ahmadinejad would have won.
It has to be said that some of them have dialed back on that a little bit since I was reporting that story. But I think it's a very real possibility that Ahmadinejad might have won, if not in the first round, in a second round. I think there's now a kind of a conventional wisdom, because it's what people want to believe, that he didn't have a chance, and that instead of winning by 63%, he really would have lost by 63%. Well, I'm not sure how you know that. There is a very large population that was not out on the streets protesting against Ahmadinejad. There is a very large population of Iran that is rural, and also urban population that enjoyed his handouts over the last 4 years, and including and especially the last few months. If ever there was a candidate who set out to buy votes, this was the man. And who's to say it didn't work? People basically have not contested, some people have, but very few people have contested his win 4 years ago. So I'm not telling you that he won fair and square. I think the fraud was about trying to show they had this massive, unassailable mandate. And whether Ahmadinejad might have won fair and square or not, that debate is always going to rely not on facts, but on people's opinions of the regime.
When you talk about Ahmadinejad buying votes, what do you mean?
He had these bonuses that were handed out to government employees, to all kinds of people. Basically, Iran has enjoyed, like every other oil producer over the last few years until a little less than a year ago, huge oil prices, huge increases in oil prices, prices much, much, much higher than anything that could have been expected when Ahmadinejad came to power 4 years ago. And as that money rolled in, he made sure that it rolled out again, often basically in terms of cash stipends. As a result, a lot of people felt he was helping them out. Now, the bad news was it created inflation that has all the impacts that we know that inflation has. People suddenly found that all that money they were getting wasn't buying as much as it used to. But the immediate effect is to say, thank you, Mr. Ahmadinejad, for giving me this money.
Christopher Dickey, good to talk with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Christopher Dickey is Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. His latest book is called Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. He spoke to us from Paris. Coming up, a perspective on the protest movement in Iran from Roya Hakakian, who grew up in revolutionary Iran and co-founded the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. This is Fresh Air. Roya Hakakian identifies with the protesters in Iran. She remembers protesting against the Shah. In 2004, she published a memoir about growing up Jewish in revolutionary Iran called Journey from the Land of No. She left the country with her parents in 1984 at the age of 18 and now lives in the U.S. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center, serves on the board of Refugees International, and is a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. Hakakian initiated last weekend's prayer campaign in memory of Neda Soltani, the young Iranian woman who in death became a symbol of the protest movement. Roya Hakakian, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you think that the protest movement in Iran is over? Has the government succeeded in repressing it? Or do you think it's just going to enter a new phase?
I don't think the protests are over. And I think what really happened during this last elections in Iran is that the nation crossed a boundary. And that boundary was the one that had never been crossed before. There was always a sense of hope about wanting to make compromises, make incremental changes, find ways of negotiating with those in power in Iran. And I think with this round of elections, with the responses from the Supreme Leader, the people in Iran have come to the conclusion that those steps that they had hoped to take to make a soft transition to change in Iran are no longer possible. So I don't expect for the protests to go away. I don't think anybody does. I just think that the movement will, in the future weeks, be retooling itself to come up with new ingenious ways to fight the system.
Like what? What are some ingenious ways that you think are possible fighting the system?
Well, I think it will adopt the formats that a lot of other covert movements have adopted in the past and historically, even in Iran against the Shah. You know, the 1978 revolution came out of about two or three decades of protests against the Shah. And I think it took a very, very long time for those things to come to a head as they manifested themselves in 1978. So it is possible that there would be a return to that era. And, you know, those acts of protest and demonstration can take a variety of shapes and forms. For instance, it's very likely that we will see a lot of labor strikes. I think people will retreat to their homes and become defiant, and those acts of defiance will manifest themselves in a variety of ways. For instance, every day now I get Facebook postings from Iran with recordings of people on their rooftops shouting Allahu Akbar or God is great. And I think people are doing this sort of as a national diary to record what's happening. And I think posting these things on a daily basis serves as a reminder to all of us that the movement is ongoing.
What does it mean to go to your rooftop and shout, God is great? How does that register as a protest? I mean, you're dealing with a clerical government who'd be shouting, God is great, too. So where's the protest in shouting that?
Well, that's the beauty of it. The nation is trying to hearken back to the images, the icons, everything that was extremely symbolic and very meaningful to the movement in 1978 and 1979. Whether this is organized or thought out, I'm not certain. But what is naturally happening spontaneously among people in Iran is that they're trying to connect this to 1978 and say, we are the same nation, and we are once again oppressed, and we once again want to get rid of our dictators, and therefore we will be using the very same symbols, the very same imagery, the very same actions that helped us overthrow a previous dictator. So going up to the rooftops is going back to the memories and the history of 1978, when people in Iran in December of 1978, I was 12, you know, I went to my rooftop because Ayatollah Khomeini had ordered people to go to the rooftops and in a completely nonviolent fashion, just shout for 10 minutes, God is great, or Allahu Akbar, in pitch dark. And I can't tell you, Terry, it was one of the most staggering experiences of my entire life to be standing on a rooftop and listening to this sound that came from nowhere because it was so dark, and yet it was so overpowering.
Do you feel that in some ways the people of Iran, particularly the younger people, grew up, you know, in a, quote, revolutionary time, and the revolution was celebrated and taught, and in that sense people were taught how to protest, a right that is now being denied to them?
Precisely. That's why I think this is such a tough position for the regime to be in, because they taught this revolution to us, even when I was in high school in Iran, every day in a variety of ways. This was part of our official textbooks. It was a big part of our history. I mean, Iran has a history of 2,500 years, and yet, you know, the overthrow of the Shah was probably five chapters in a 12-chapter history book. They really drilled it into us, and we really embraced it, especially the youth in Iran, as a proud moment in our history when we together as one had gotten rid of a dictator. And because they drilled in all those lessons to us so consistently, we, in a way, were educated by them, or I should say the nation has been educated by the very people who now have to deal with young people on the streets who are trying to overthrow them using the same strategies and tactics.
Well, Ahmadinejad is scheduled to be sworn in late July or early August. So, like, once he's in office, it's no longer about contesting the election. So the protests seem like they have to take on a different goal.
They already have. There have been several smaller demonstrations throughout Iran, especially Tehran in the past week, when the millions and millions have gone away to their homes and are probably thinking through other acts. I have received YouTube installments of, you know, what looks like street skirmishes, you know, 20 protesters coming out of the subway, chanting and protesting, and then fading away. On the other hand, the regime, of course, will not be quiet, and they have to deal with 2,000, 3,000 people that they have sitting in prisons at the moment. It seems like in the past day or two, they have executed a few. I saw the news of about six people being hung yesterday in Mashhad. And I think these acts, which I expect to be coming forth, will serve to inflame the public even further. And what's interesting for me to watch is that this movement has made a commitment to do what the movement against the Shah hadn't made a commitment to do, which is to remain nonviolent. This is probably one of the most moving experiences that I've had watching Iran in the past 30 years. I have seen several video installments of people who have been confronted by the members of the Revolutionary Guards who have come to attack them. And there have been protesters on the streets who have made a human ring around these five or six Revolutionary Guard members to protect them from the wrath of the crowd. This, I think, more than anything, shows that this population, this movement, is committed to remaining nonviolent and gaining whatever it is that it's trying to through peaceful means.
Where do you think that comes from, that nonviolent resistance? Certainly not from the 1979 revolution.
I think precisely because the 1979 revolution led to such a terrible disaster that people are trying to do everything possible to avoid another experience like that. And I think, you know, there are instances that Iranians have embraced, again, because of the massive propaganda by the regime, of various movements throughout the world. For instance, you know, the apartheid experience in South Africa. We learned a great deal about Nelson Mandela when we were in schools in Iran. I remember the only great American leader that I was ever taught about was Martin Luther King when I was a student in Iran in high school. So it's ironic that the regime itself has embraced and implemented in Iranian education, post-revolutionary education, these important figures as figures to be beheld by Iranians, you know, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King. And I think those lessons are now enlightening the current movement.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Roya Hakakian. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. She serves on the board of Refugees International. She grew up in Iran and left as a teenager with her family for the United States. She also wrote a memoir a few years ago about growing up in revolutionary Iran called Journey from the Land of No. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roya Hakakian. She's a founding member of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. She serves on the board of Refugees International. She initiated a prayer campaign on behalf of Neda Soltani, the young Iranian woman who was killed during the protests. She also, a few years ago, wrote a memoir about growing up in revolutionary Iran called Journey from the Land of No. She and her family left Iran for the United States when she was 18. Women have been very active in this protest in Iran. Do you see that as, in part, you know, protest against the suppression of women in Iran?
Absolutely. But what's even more interesting to me is that people find that surprising. The most vibrant, the most serious, the strongest opposition that the Iranian regime has ever faced in the past 30 years has been the opposition to its existence by the Iranian women. It's an opposition that has been unfolding itself from the very early days of the revolution, because, you know, on March 8th of 1979, which was, you know, barely a month after the Iranian revolution had taken hold and the Ayatollah had returned, the Iranian women took to the streets and staged a massive march against a decree that the Ayatollah had issued to implement the Islamic dress code, meaning to bring back the veil. Now, a lot of people forget that Iranian women had historically had the right to dress code. In other words, at a time when I was growing up, some women were under the veil and others were not. Women chose how they wanted to dress and went about it in that way. But on March 8th, women took to the streets to demonstrate against Ayatollah's decree to bring back the veil and make it mandatory. And, you know, it's an opposition that has been organizing, strategizing, and thinking through its demands very seriously, at least for the last 10 years. So I think it's no surprise that we see women in the forefront of this movement. And it is really the women that have provided the engine, the organization know-how for the pre-election campaign.
Neda Soltani became a symbol of the protest movement, you know, a young Iranian woman who was killed while protesting. And a lot of people have noted how different she is as a symbol from the bearded middle-aged men of the 1979 revolution. You initiated a prayer campaign on her behalf. Was it last weekend, 2 weekends ago?
Last weekend. We're hoping to bring everybody together for the 40th day of her death.
So what does she mean to you? You were 18 when you left Iran. You were 12 when you protested against the Shah. So what does seeing her face mean to you?
You know, I wrote a very bad poem, which I have kept on my laptop and haven't shown to anyone. The poem really was about seeing myself in Neda. I think, I have no doubt that if I were in Iran now, I would be on the streets. Because when I was 12, I was on the streets. I have no doubt that I would be protesting along with the women, with the others who are on the streets. And I have no doubt that I could have died too. I mean, oftentimes when I think about the stupid things that I did when I was a teenager in Iran, the idea that I survived my stupidity, the idea that I encouraged so much danger and yet somehow survived, staggers me. So I think she's the face of the Iranian movement, but not just the current one, the one that began in 1979. I think the majority of the secular Iranians who joined that revolution joined because they were hoping to have a democracy in Iran, to have an egalitarian rule. And that hope still survives. And I think no one better than Neda captures that that hope that has yet to come to fruition.
So now that you've been living in the United States since 1984,
Since
1985, thank you. You've been trying your best to keep in touch with people in Iran. Mm-hmm. And Americans are seeing a different side of Iranians now. They're not chanting death to America. So what are you hoping that Americans are learning about Iran as they try to keep track of what's happening there now?
The Iran that Americans have been seeing in the past 3 weeks is the Iran that I've always known, is an Iran that has wanted freedom and equality. And I think what always devastated me, because I'm also an American now, was what a terrible view we as Americans held of Iran, especially the Iran that I knew. And I always wanted to somehow help settle this misunderstanding that we were the victims of of the very regime, of the very characters who were burning, you know, the American flags on the streets of Tehran, or burning the effigies of Uncle Sam. So I hope that this latest movement has helped people see Iran in the way that I know Iran. And I hope that we as Americans come to embrace what's happening in Iran today as a universal plight, because I see it as, as a situation which is basically a gender apartheid. And we as global citizens wouldn't want to be living in an era where gender apartheid, where apartheid of any kind is in existence.
Rhea Hakakian, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate it. Be well.
I was delighted to be with you. Thank you.
Rhea Hakakian is the co-founder of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center and is a fellow at Yale University's Whitney Humanities Center. We've invited her back next week to talk about her memoir, Journey from the Land of No. It's about growing up Jewish in revolutionary Iran. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.